Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Man there trying to stop Joe from getting himself into further trouble.
It's a fucking disgrace.
That's not a bad ball for Pelé on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
Maradona just walked away from Hoddle then. Cardano smokes and
Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee.
Half finale komen. Ik heb opeens zo'n gevoel dat we in de halve finale gaan komen. Met de balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal. Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp.
Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp.
So welcome to the Scoreless Toilet Podcast. I'm your host, Alex, as always, and I'm delighted to be joined by Gary Thacker on the podcast today. Welcome, Gary. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Not a problem, Alex. Thanks for inviting me on board. Always happy to talk about football for a while.
Yeah, I invited Gary on to talk about his book, Beautiful Bridesmaids Dressed in Orange, which I have with me here, just to prove the pudding, I guess, as he does as well. Just to introduce yourself maybe a little bit, Gary, for our listeners, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and also, I mean, the idea behind the book that you wanted to get across?
Sure. Well, I came into writing about football quite late in life, so probably in my mid-50s when I sort of made that sort of move. This is my fifth book. I've had a very long relationship with these Football Times. We do podcasts and work for their magazines as well. As well as football history books, such as this one, written the one on the England in the World Cup. I've also written a couple of novels, which come out recently, one last year and one came out, sorry, one year before last and one came out in November, just sort of in between the Beautiful Bridesmaids, sat in between them. I do a lot of podcasts for the Football Times. They write for the magazines. I've been on radio with BBC, TalkSport. I write a weekly column for an English language newspaper over in Spain on La Liga. So it keeps me pretty busy. I've had three books come out in the last 10 months, so it's been a bit hectic some time. And I'm currently working. I've got my sixth book is coming out in mid-April, which is about Chelsea and the 2012 European Cup or Champions League in New Orleans, it's called. And then I'm currently working through a book for 2023, which looks at the great Ajax teams of the early 70s that won three successive European Cups. I'm a massive fan of Dutch football. Yeah. I was just at my sort of impressionable years when, you know, the great Ajax teams and Dutch teams came to fruition. So that's why I tend to sort of write a lot about Dutch football, because it just entranced me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write in the book, I think in the introduction, you open with that at the time that you saw Cruyff's Barcelona at Aston Villa. Do you want to kind of talk a little bit about like the impression that had on you?
Yeah, I mean, he was sort of toward the end of his career then, but it was, as I say, I'm a massive advocate of Dutch football. I love Dutch football. And when Villa drew Barcelona, I think it was the UEFA Cup tournaments, I had to go. I think it was about sort of October, November, so I'm fairly early in the competition. But it was a typical wet night in Birmingham. I used to live in Walsall, which is just north of Birmingham, so a bit of a travel to get there. But the pitch was absolutely sodden. And Cruyff was playing for Barcelona. And it's really weird, but I've seen some great players in my lifetime, both Ronaldo's, Messi, Ronaldinho, and Cruyff is right up there. With these players, it's sometimes like, I mean, it sounds stupid to say it, like their feet don't actually touch the ground. Mm. Whereas, you know, the mere mortals on the pitch were sort of slogging through the mud. Cruyff was like a pond skater gliding under the surface, and it's got a wonderful goal that night as well. And I mean, I'd say I was in transfer football from an early age, my sort of mid-teens. But it was great to see. It's, you know, they say about the Grand Canyon, it's the one thing in life that doesn't disappoint when you go to see it.
Yeah.
Well, same's true of Cruyff.
That was same for Cruyff. You went along, just I presume, just to see Cruyff, right? That was
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So moving on to our main subject, to talk about the Dutch football, in particular the 70s. I think it's a very interesting story about basically how the national team sort of came from nothing, because you have the period, you know, they'd been to the World Cups before the war, but nothing since. So how come Dutch football basically exploded, both in the club sides with the, you know, success with in the European Cup with Ajax, and then also at the World Cup, like what's changed?
It's a crazy story. It's an absolute crazy story. Before they reached the 74 World Cup finals in Germany, the Dutch national team had a record in the World Cup equivalent to that of Luxembourg. They hadn't won a single game in a World Cup finals tournament, although they attended a couple, as you say, pre-war. They hadn't qualified since the 1938 tournament, so the 32 years. I'll sort of come back to 74, but just to touch on how weird Dutch football is. They got to the final in 74, and the first time they qualified for 30-odd years.
Yeah.
They got to the final 4 years later, again losing to the hosts, and didn't qualify again till I think it was 1992. Absolutely crazy. Dutch football is always, I always liken Dutch football to a flame. It burns really, really brightly, but it doesn't burn for long. And, you know, there's many theories. I touch on some of the theories about, you know, why there was this great bursting of the flame in the 70s. And, you know, there's a couple of theories, main theories. One is which it was the development of total football, which Rinus Michels at Ajax and Ernst Happel at Feyenoord in Rotterdam had sort of picked up, although the history of total football is lost in the mist of time. Times it goes back to Jack Reynolds at Ajax in the 30s. And the other thing was there was a crop of exceptionally talented players put together by those two coaches. So the reality is it's probably a lot from column A and a lot from column B. But they were, you know, a terrific team, the Oranges, especially in 74, because Cruyff was there in 74, he wasn't there in 78. But I spoke to several Dutch journalists and authors, football authors in the Netherlands, who sort of, you know, studied this period. And, you know, there's this sort of, there's a guy called Jan Herman de Bruyne, who's quite a famous journalist over in the Netherlands, and he said to me, there's no one in life more arrogant than a Dutchman when they have a little bit of success. And it was that arrogance that took the Oranje to so much success in 74, but in the end it was also their bane. You know, they, in the final when they played West Germany and they scored in, you know, something minute before, you know, the first German player to touch the ball was Meyer Fischer at the onion bad after Niskin's penalty. And instead of hammering on to try and get the second goal and kill the game off, they decided they wanted to humiliate the Germans. I mean, obviously, we have to remember this is sort of 30-odd years after the end of the Second World War. And a lot of the Dutch players of that era, their parents, uncles and other relations, was in the Dutch Dutch occupation by the Germans. So there was that seething resentment still bubbling away. Mm-hmm. So it was a massive thing. Wim Gerne Hanegem, who played in that game, I think he lost his brother in an air raid. in the Second World War. So it was a big thing. And as I say, there's a I had an interview with Raphael Honigstein, mentioned in the book, and he says there that if the Germans had scored inside the first minute, there's no way they wanted to close the game out, because they just wanted to win the game, whereas the Dutch wanted to be far more elaborate and just destroy the Germans.
Mm-hmm. If you had to describe the key tenets of total football, what would you say they are? Because, I mean, it feels like something that I've sort of, you hear and you kind of recognize it when you see it, but I'm not entirely sure exactly what.
Do you know, you know, it's weird. In the book I'm working at the moment, so the Ajax book, I've got a whole chapter devoted to what is total football. And I've got interviews with you know, several. David Winner, who wrote Brilliant Orange, I've got in contact with David, and he gave me an interview, and he gave me his theory. I've got an interview with Ruud Krol, who played in the Orange team and also in the Ajax team as well. I've got interviews with Peter Vermeulen, who was played at the same time, although he played for a different club. But it's different. It's difficult to pin down. In as much as it means different things to different people. Basically, there's lots of elements that you can trip off the tongue, and it's, you know, it's an ability to play in different positions. It's a dedication to, when you haven't got the ball, to press. It's you play a high line to play offside, or to compress the play, to threaten to play players offside. It's a comfort on the ball. No matter what position you play, be it right back, centre forward, centre half, or left wing, you've got to be able to play in the other positions as well. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the goal in 74 World Cup final was an example of that. When Cruyff picks up the ball before he starts that run where he's fetched down by Hoeneß in the area, he's the deepest Dutch player. There's only Jan Youngblood behind him. Mm-hmm. It's a question I get asked quite often. The answer is too complex. People understand it. It's almost an emotional thing, as much as a sort of practical thing that you can say. It's not 4-4-2 or 4-3-3. It's not like that. It's not a formation. It's a sense, almost a belief, a commitment.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that I found very striking when I went back and watched some of the matches from the 1974 World Cup and also the highlights on YouTube is something which I had not expected. You know, I expected to see, you know, the intricate passing and the movement and everything, but the thing that found almost more fascinating was them without the ball, because on this podcast we've watched some, you know, classic games from before this. So we watched like the 1966 World Cup final between England and West Germany, and also the 1954 with Hungary against West Germany. And one of the things that's very striking, I find, when you watch football from that period is the sort of time on the ball and lack of the other team sort of pressing. And then you have the Netherlands and this almost sort of kamikaze looking like movement of the other team has the ball, and there's like five of them hurtling at them, and they're on this offside line, which is always on the halfway line. Like, where did this come from? Because it just looks so sort of alien compared to what the other teams were doing.
It is an element of total football. You're right. When you look at it, it's almost like the hunting in packs.
Yeah.
To the player in possession, and you know, you see, and this sort of pressing game that's become an established trend across football in the last sort of, I don't know, five, ten years or so. This is nothing new. The Dutch were doing this. Where are we now? 50 years ago. But it was the way Ajax played, and as well as did Feyenoord to some extent, but not perhaps in a slightly different way. But the interesting thing about the Dutch defence is the goalkeeper and the two centre-backs were about the fourth or fifth choice players for those positions. Harry Hahn, who played in midfield for Ajax, was co-opted by Mikkels to play as a centre-back. Royce Bergen was a young kid. I think he got one cap previous to the World Cup, and he was actually a full-back, and he was played as a centre-half. Jan Youngblood, the goalkeeper, had played 5 minutes of international football 12 years before that game, before the opening game. Mm-hmm. And in that 5 minutes of a sub, he conceded a goal. And when there was a lot of discussion about the goalkeeper and position.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people wanted, there was another guy, Van Beveren, who was supposed to be
a complex character. He played for PSV Eindhoven, and he had an injury a few months before the World Cup. And Piet Schreiber played in his place in the national team. Now, Van Beveren was sort of fairly well recovered even before the tournament, was selected for the squad initially. And Mikkels had arranged a friendly before the tournament with a German club. I think it was Hamburg. I'm not sure. It might have been Hamburg. And he wanted Van Beveren to play to prove his fitness.
Yeah.
And Van Beveren didn't want to risk it. And he said, look, if you really, really want me to play, I'll play half a go at the game, but I don't really want to. And Mikkels said, well, that's not good enough. And kicked him out of the squad. This was by far the best goalkeeper in the Netherlands, and one of the best, if not the best, in Europe at the time. And then instead of picking the guy who had covered for Van Beveren while he was injured, there's a lot of talk that Cruyff was a big influence. They opted for Jan Youngblood because the argument was he was a better footballer than the other possible mm-hmm. replacements. And yet, at this time in 1974, there's none of these sorts of, you can't play the ball back, you can't back pass the goalkeeper, you can back pass the goal. And in that entire tournament, and I've watched the games, as you probably imagine, many times, I think there's only one time when Youngblood comes out of his area to get the ball, and he just hoops it up the park.
So do you think that's almost an excuse they've sort of made? Because they can't obviously just say, we didn't like Van Beveren, we wanted our friend Youngblood in. So they sort of come up with this, you know.
The strange thing is, Youngblood had no connection with Ajax at all. He played for FC Amsterdam, where another club in Amsterdam at the time. And if Mikkels had rated Youngblood that highly, when he was recruiting players, there's a guy called Goebbels, who played in the early years for Ajax after Mikkels arrived there. And when it was time for him to be replaced, he didn't go for Youngblood.
Yeah.
Hein Stoi. So Youngblood had really got no great connection. But this was the theory that he was the guy that could play with his feet as well as being a semi-decent goalkeeper. And in fairness, you have to say, you know, even with a cobbled defence, they only conceded one goal before reaching the World Cup.
Yeah, that was another thing which I found super interesting because, I mean, we watched, I think there's often a sort of comparison made between, you know, three great triumphant failures of the World Cup, obviously. So you have Hungary in 1954, then you have the Dutch team in 1974, and then Brazil in 1982. But I mean, watching Brazil in 1982, you could see why they lose, because they're just, you know, defending all over the place. And I mean, you watch that game against Italy, and you're like, you can see, I mean, how brilliant Brazil are going forward, but at the back, they're just an absolute mess. But then you have, I mean, the Netherlands, the Dutch team, they only concede one goal, like you said, on the way to the whole, on the way to the final. So they were doing, it's not as if they sort of completely neglected that other side of the game.
Yeah. I mean, and that goal they conceded, I think, was against Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm. In the 4-1 win, yeah.
There were four goals up at the time, and it was an own goal by Kroll, trying to cut out across. It was in the last two or three minutes of a game when there were four. And so it's not as if it mattered that much anyway. It was the last group game. They only need to win to qualify. So, yeah, I mean, even in the final. But perhaps the biggest problem they had was the two best centre-backs in the Netherlands in the Eredivisie were Rinus Israël, who played for Feyenoord, and Barry Holschoff, who played for Ajax. Now, Holschoff was an amazing talent. He only played about 13 games for the Dutch national team as a centre-half, and scored six or seven goals. A goal every other game from centre-half, not as a striker. I mean, a striker's proud of that international record.
Yeah.
But he had a serious knee injury a month or so, 2 months before the World Cup finals, and he couldn't play. And he never played for the Dutch again, and he destroyed his career. And Rinus Israël had an injury as well. But Mikkels took him anyway to the final. He came on and played a couple of substitute appearances. But the defence, with Van Beveren and Rinus Israël and Barry Holschoff in that defence, you can bring who you like. I just don't think you can score. And the goals they conceded in the final to the Germans, The first one was a penalty, which was an interesting. The first one was. Yes, it was a penalty. And it's an interesting thing. There's Hotzenbein is the German guy who went down, shall we say, in the penalty area under an alleged touch. You look, I mean, I've looked this many, many times. It's questionable whether arm actually touches him. No, he's Janssen, not Stochan. I think it's Janssen. And I was talking to this guy I mentioned earlier, De Bruyne, and there's a German word that's become co-opted into the Dutch language, and it's Schwalbe, which actually translated directly means swallow, but it actually means like a swallow dive.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the Dutch are absolutely convinced that he died for the penalty. And Schwalbe has now become a Dutch word, and it means they use it for anything that's sharp practice in sport.
Yeah.
Should it have been a penalty? It's debatable. And Jack Taylor was refereeing, the English referee was refereeing the final. And a few years later, he said, I think I made a mistake. And I would say he almost certainly didn't fall credit to the guy for having the guts to come out and say it afterwards. Yeah. The second goal was when Hahn was caught out, probably the first time, and looking like a midfielder playing centre-half. And Muller, the ace goal poacher, exploited a little bit of space.
Is Hahn the defender who tries to make the tackle out wider?
Yes, he gets exposed, yeah. And it's strange because Youngblood, on both of the goals, doesn't really make an effort for either of them.
He stands
and waves the ball by.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's very, I find his reaction to both of the, a penalty, whatever, it's you know, pretty rare to say, but with the other shot, he's just sort of caught flat-footed in a way that he's, you know, not able to make a move for it. But, I mean, obviously a lot of people are kind of aware of, like, the big names on this team, like Cruyff and Neskens and stuff and Van Hanegem, but who are some of these sort of other players on that great team that people were maybe, like, a little bit less aware of?
I guess from my point of view, they're all pretty well.
Perhaps,
you know, so in defence, perhaps the other guy that gets rarely mentioned is Dim Serbia.
Yeah.
Serbia played for Ajax many, many years and is one of the sort of pioneers of an overlapping fullback. And in many goals, I think in one of the European Cup ties for Ajax, in one of the away legs, they won two, and he scored both goals, almost playing like a right winger, very much perhaps people would something to associate him to give an idea. You see Dani Alves used to play at Barcelona in his prime. Not now, I mean, he's 38 now, but in his prime, he was that sort of rampaging fullback. But he was a great defence as well. He never neglected his defence. So I think Serbia is one to mention. And perhaps another couple, I'll pick one from midfield, which is probably Wim Jansen, who... Yeah. Perhaps Celtic fans will know him and love him for managing Celtic for a season when they stopped Rangers getting the 10th championship in a row. And he played for Feyenoord. And the sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Quiet, sort of unobtrusive player. But in the second half, when basically the Dutch lay siege to the German goal, often Janssen left back on his own to sort of watch the back door, as it were. And perhaps the other one is Robbie Rensenbrink, who, strange enough, never played. He played a couple of seasons in Dutch football.
At Anderlecht, was that right?
He made his name. We went to Bruges first and then went to Anderlecht and won European trophies with Anderlecht. And he used to call him, I don't know the Dutch word off the top of my head, but the snake man. Because he could wriggle out of it. He got this ability to dribble past players and also to burst past them, amazing turn of pace. And Rensenbrink had a problem. He spanned a hamstring in the game against Brazil and he should have missed the final. But he wants to miss a World Cup final and he played. He only played the first half and had to come off because he obviously wasn't fit. But I say to my mind, you know, they're all stars, but those are perhaps three less known perhaps.
So the Dutch had this, you know, brilliant run to the final and were making like smooth progress. And then before the final there, and I think with all these games, finals, it gets sort of like clouded and kind of like mystery of circumstances and stuff like this. And obviously you have with this one, the kind of build story about the party and then Cruyff having to talk to his, you know, smooth things over, shall we say, with his wife and that kind of thing. In your research and everything that you said, do you think this played a big impact on the Dutch in the final, or do you think this is just another one of those sort of things that comes up after?
I don't think it did, because they didn't need any more incentive to beat the Germans. It was one of these things, and, you know, I've read so much about this, and, you know, you don't want to say I think it's true, but there seems to be a lot of evidence to suggest it was true, although Bild did say they'd got photographs, but they never produced them. And you're right. I mean, close to what Danny was, they had extensive phone calls, apparently, that, you know, to sort of protest his innocence of these things. But, you know, footballers. the old sort of saying that, you know, you need a united squad to sort of succeed at tournament football. You need to sort of together. The Dutch were never that. Kaiser, for example, had fell out with, Cruyff fell out with Kaiser. Although they were very close. Pete Kaiser was the first professional footballer at Ajax. Cruyff was the second. And I think Kaiser was about 4 years older than Cruyff, and he was sort of had him under his wing, as it were, for a long time. Each year at Ajax, they have an election to decide who should be captain. And Cruyff had been captain in this 72-73 season, the last time they won the European Cup. And for the following season, there was new money brought in because Stefan Kovacs had gone to manage the French national side, and a guy called George Noble came in. He was not up to the job. And they had this election, and Kaiser was elected, apparently. And Cruyff never forgave him for this. So, you know, I guess then you look at the...
Because I've read about the sort of divisions between, the club teams and stuff like this, but you said it was, you know, it was even further among teammates.
There was a lot of personal animosity. And after 74, going towards the 76 European Championship, Cruyff and Neeskens were both... I mean, Neeskens signed for Barcelona in the middle of the World Cup. I mean, how crazy is that? Now, Cruyff and Neeskens were both at Barcelona. And George Noble, actually, after spending 1 year with Ajax and getting the sack of winning nothing with a team that dominated European football for 3 years, got the job with the Dutch national team. I mean, this is crazy.
Why did they, if he'd failed at Ajax, why would...
I don't know. I really don't know. They've got this strange system because in 74, Mikkels was coach for the tournament, but he hadn't qualified them.
Mikkels went to the week of the final, right? He went back to Barcelona to manage a game.
It was the Copa del Rey final. The Spanish Cup final, against Real Madrid. And obviously there was these two key players, Cruyff and Neeskens, weren't even there. It's anything, you know, you could say about Dutch football doesn't surprise you, because it's like a bobsleigh ride. It's fast and it's frantic, and sometimes it's exhilarating, but other times it can be a right disaster. Whenever the things are going well, somebody has to turn the table over. Somebody's got to cause a rumpus, and it's happened so many times. And as I said, you know, Mikkels had been parachuted in. A guy called Fredonk, who was Czech born, although I think was nationalized Dutch at the time, had got them there. And the same thing happened in 78. There's a guy called Jan Svartkruis, who actually was coach all the way up to the 78 World Cup final tournament. And then Ernst Happel, was parachuted in to take over from there. It's just so crazy that the way they did things there.
But so in the final, I mean, you watch it and they score the goal, and then as the story goes, they were so sort of, you know, arrogant or boy, they wanted to humiliate the Germans, and then by not scoring the second goal and stuff like this, and then the Germans come back and win the game. But then I've read, because I think this is also like the narrative that is generally sort of told about this game, right? Like, you know, that, you know, the arrogance of the Dutch came back to bite them. But I think I read something once before, and it was kind of like a German perspective on this game.
Yes.
And from the German perspective, it's like, well, we started badly, but we, you know, they got lucky, and then we sort of, you know, were the better team in the end, and we came out on top. How much is sort of reality matching sort of popular story? Because, you know, we want to have this kind of triumphant failure, and it doesn't fit into that narrative that maybe the German team were quite a decent side too. Or, you know, what does it work?
It's a really interesting point. As I mentioned, I was fortunate to have an interview with Raphael Honigstein. Yeah. And I wanted to ask him about this specific point. And he said, because he came to study in university in England, and he said, until he arrived in England, this narrative of the beautiful Dutch footballers being unlucky and not winning the time, the German efficiency destroyed the view.
Yeah.
There's no perception of that in Germany. Very much like you said, you know, the Dutch were good, but Germany were better, and they won. Yeah. That sort of thing. And, he said, I really found it difficult for a while. And then he got sort of to understand why it was viewed differently. And, you know, if you watch the game, I'm sure you have, and I've watched it several times. Yeah. And in fact, well, if you watch the tournament, the Dutch were a far better football team throughout the tournament than Germany were. But West Germany, you know, Borsman Dorf technique, you know, they got the job done when it needed to be done. And, you know, if the Dutch perhaps had that mentality that Honigstein said the Germans would have had if they'd gone ahead and, you know, inside the first minute or so, and just bombed for the second goal, while you're on top and, you know, your opponents, you know, the heads ain't clear yet.
Yeah.
Only get the second goal, kill the game off. Perhaps the story would have been different. But would people have loved the Dutch so much if they had been had that mentality? I mean, you know, in the best stories, the hero always dies in the last reel, doesn't he? So, I mean, there's that sort of, you know, the best songs are written with a broken heart.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And I think so after 74, the Dutch team in 76, they lose in the semi-final of the Euro Championships, right? And I think then a new coach comes in again, or what's...
Well, basically, it was a mini tournament. There was only four teams there.
Yeah.
And they played the Czechs, and it was a terrible environment. The pitch had been sodden with days of rain. There was a gale blowing. Cruyff wasn't fit. He had a knee injury and probably shouldn't have played. And the referee was anybody of my vintage, called, you know, the infamy of Clive Thomas, the Three Orkies terror. And he was in one of his moods, and he fell out with Van Hammen. He actually sent Van Hammen going off in injury extra time as well. And that was the tournament, you know, in 74, 76 and 78. The 76 tournament was the one that in the Netherlands think that's the one they should have won. They should have won more, but that's the one they should have won the most.
Yeah.
Because they were by far the better team. And after that sort of fell away, Gabel left. And as I said, there was a guy called Jan Zwartkruis. Now, Jan Zwartkruis had never managed a club, professional club, in his life. He was actually in the Dutch Air Force, and he used to coach the Dutch military team. And a few of the players who played in the 74 tournament, Hulshoff, didn't play. I think Kaiser came through, Van Beveren came through there, but two or three others came through the Dutch national because of conscription in the sort of 50s and 60s. And he was he worked at the KNVB, the Dutch FA, in their sort of back room, as it were, coaching teams, and he was asked to stand in for three or four games while they selected on the coach. But he did really well, and he was popular with the players as well, because a lot of the players knew him, and Nobble had been such a disaster as both at Ajax and as the he was not loved. He certainly wasn't respected. Van Hanegem, on the day of the 76 semi-final, fell out with him, and basically said, you know, you're up to this. And Novel, in typical Spike terms, just dropped him, made him a substitute. Well, they should have been playing, and Cruyff was injured, but Hanegem not playing, so he didn't feel good pieces. So Zwartkruis took over, and he was him who got them to the 78 tournament in Argentina, although Happel had been seconded to.
But it's also unclear at this stage whether, you know, the coach was actually picking the team or whether it was Cruyff, because, I mean, there's plenty of stories of players being...
Yeah, well, obviously, Zwartkruis hadn't got a lot of capital, shall we say, not what Mikkels had. He had to prove himself, although, as I say, was popular with the players. But Happel did, although officially his contract didn't start until the World Cup, he did want to get involved at the time, and there was a big problem. And at one stage, they both resigned and because of the conflict between them. And the Dutch FA became, and I'm trying to think of the words, so forgive me if I'm wrong. One was called the supervisor, and one was called the top coach or something. So they came it was a case of, well, you know, believe the description of how you described how you want to, if that makes you feel better. And they both came back.
We're both equal, but one of us is more equal than the other.
Yeah, well, that, you know, it's like saying, you know, oh, well, look, you might be the top coach, but I'm the supervisor. Supervisor, but it wasn't the top coach, it was something else. But it was both were sort of misty names that could have been interpreted either way, and they were by each one, which satisfied their egos.
Okay. Yeah, so, and then, I mean, the Dutch team at 78, but they're obviously missing Cruyff and Van Hanegem. So Cruyff is staying at home because of this break-in, you know, this traumatic experience with his family. And Van Hanegem, how come he's not? Is he?
Van Hanegem is a really strong personality. And in 74 and 76, the players had agreed that all members of the squad and the backroom staff would share in the pot from promotional activities, regardless of who it was. And Cruyff was obviously the major producer of brass for the. But it was shared out. And Van Hanegem had this reasoning that if there's somebody else doesn't clean my boots, I've got to clean them myself. So he should have a share as well. Well, in 78, three or four of the players decided they didn't want to put their money in the pot. They wanted to keep it for themselves. And in typical Van Hanegem way, he said, well, this isn't the attitude I want. I'm not going to subscribe to this. And he opted out. Now, this is a big loss for Happel. Happel had been manager of Feyenoord for a while, and Van Hanegem was like his presence on the field. He was the main playmaker for the Feyenoord. And when Mikkels came in 74, it was easy for him because of the big chunk of the first team players were Ajax players who played under Mikkels. Although actually, strangely enough, I think the figures are that there were six Ajax players and seven Feyenoord ones, although the Ajax players played more.
Yeah,
but in 78, Happel, the main guy, Happel's main man, like Mikkels would be to Cruyff, Van Hanegem was to Happel. And when he dipped out of the tournament, apparently watching it on a Spanish beach, he lost his lead on the field. So it damaged Happel quite a lot and his way of playing.
Yeah, I mean. So the Dutch team got to the final in 78, but I mean, were they in any way a match for the team in 74? Or, well, you know, because the 74 is so well remembered, and it's almost, I feel like it's somewhat almost forgotten that they were in the final again in 4 years later.
Yeah. In 74, Mikkels picked the same players to start the game, except for one exception, which was the game against Sweden. When he put Kaiser in instead of Rensenbrink, but that on for that one game. In 78, the team were changed quite often from game to game. And then in this situation, it was Sparkreuz and Happel's influence to which way they would play. And they brought quite a lot of young players into the through during the tournament, like Pete Wildschut, who I actually managed to get an interview with my Ajax book I'm doing at the moment. So that the team developed more as it went along, and it was when they got to the final. By they got to the final in 78. Excuse me. That was probably they were at their epitome then. Whereas in 74, they were at their best almost all through the tournament. Mm-hmm. If 78 team played 74 team, I'm pretty certain 74 team would win.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in 78, I mean The game is 1-1 against Argentina, and one of these sort of sliding doors moments is they hit the post in the 90th minute, which would have won the game. Who is the player who hits the post again? Sorry, I've forgotten.
Rensenbrink.
Rensenbrink. Okay.
Yeah, it's actually and I think I've got this in the book that it's a long free. It's one each as you say, and Kroll smashes this ball from his own half the field. And the strange thing is, the Argentine defence, who had been so sort of well drilled, let the ball bounce.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's inside the penalty area or not far outside the penalty area. And then dips in, and Rensenbrink comes dashing in from his left flank. And he just prods the ball past, I can't remember the Argentine goalkeeper's name. Anyway, he sort of star jumps and the ball goes. And it looks like it, from one angle I've seen, it looks like it's going in. And then it almost spins away, hits the post. And, you know, it was the moment where, he could have been the all-time Dutch hero. All the stories would have been about Rensenbrink rather than Cruyff. But
exactly.
The moment he passed away. But it's a great passage in David Winner's book, in Brilliant Orange. And he had an interview with Rensenbrink, who died a few years ago, God rest his soul, says he wished that he'd missed by a big distance.
Yeah.
And then nobody would keep asking him about it, because every time he does, he brings back and you think how close I was to immortality.
Yeah, exactly. And I presume, imagine if they had won the World Cup in 78. I mean, in some ways, the 74 team would almost be overshadowed in some ways.
Yeah. The big question is, if that goal had gone in, would they have been allowed to win?
Yeah.
I mean, the military junta in Argentina had been so influential in the things that went on in the tournament. I managed to get an interview via one of the colleagues on this Football Times with Abraham Klein, the referee, World Cup referee.
Yeah.
And he was slated for the final. He'd been the outstanding referee in the tournament. But in a group game, he'd refereed Argentina against Italy. And whereas so many other officials of the Argentina games have been pressurized by the crowd and, you know, to give free kicks and penalties, it turned down two penalty appeals, which weren't penalties, they're absolutely correct decisions.
Yeah.
But the Argentines apparently vetoed him playing. They had no ability, no sanction, they're allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The FIFA gave in, and the guy went to an Italian guy. His name I can't remember off the top of my head. But throughout that final, this guy refereeing knew the only reason he was there was because of Argentina.
Yeah.
Now, whether that puts pressure on you or influences you to be kind to that that team, but if you watch the game again, there's an awful lot of decisions to go Argentina as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think a lot of people are probably aware of the stories as well around the Argentina-Peru game seemed to take a little bit of.
I was fortunate. We had a guy who does a lot of podcasts with us, called Dr. Pete. He was a lecturer at Leeds University on South American studies, and he's written several books about papers about football. And his knowledge on this thing is amazing. And there's so much evidence that there was collusion between, whether it's the leader of the military to go into the proven dressing room, whether it's about money being released, whether it's about grain shipments, whether it's about swapping prisoners. When there's three things, you think, okay, might be true. When there's 79,863 elements that suggest it's true, you have to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it also, I mean, in some like in 74, the Dutch were able to sort of blame the referee Taylor and other stuff for them losing, isn't it? In some ways, again, like a kind of somewhat nice cushion to say, well, even if we had been beaten again, been beating Argentina, it wouldn't have been allowed to happen. I feel like it's a little bit like another crutch. Maybe I'm being too harsh on the Dutch.
No, I
mean,
it's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. I mean, what this the question is, are they excuses or are they reasons?
Yeah,
and it's probably a little bit of each. You know, I mean. If it is a reason, then, in 74, they were unlucky. Well, let's put it like that. I won't say they cheated, but they were unlucky. In 78, they may well have been cheated.
No, exactly. I feel like I'm sounding a little bit like Roy Keane. This is wildly off topic. But when Ireland failed to qualify for the 2010 World Cup with the playoff against France, when Thierry Henry handballs the ball and it puts the cross and puts it in gas and scores. And then obviously in Ireland, we were tearing our hair out, breaking our Henry the Hoovers and that kind of thing, just, complete personal pandemonium. And Roy Keane was manager of Ipswich at the time and was told, was asked about his opinion about it at a press conference. And he was like, if I was the manager, I wouldn't even mention the handball. I'd say, why didn't somebody go in and put their head in it? Why didn't Paul McShane or someone that close, you know, headed the ball away rather than it running through to Henry? Anyway, I don't.
No, I mean, so I guess the thing is with TV and radio punditry, I mean, I've been on TalkSport a couple of times in the past, and the thing is there is be controversial.
Yeah.
If you want to get voted back, be controversial, because nobody wants to listen to somebody boring and says, well, yeah, it should have been a penalty, but we should have got beat, yeah. We should have won or whatever. They like controversy.
Yeah,
exactly. That's what gets people listening. But so I take on board what you're saying, and as I say, you know, suddenly, you know, the border between a reason and excuse is often blurred.
Yeah, exactly. We have a question here from Fergus Young on the 78 World Cup, and he'd want to know if Gary thinks the Dutch would have won the final if Cruyff and Van Hanegem had gone to the 78 World Cup.
That's a wonderful question.
Yeah.
You know, I'm almost tempted to say they would have won the World Cup if either.
Yeah.
As I say, Van Hanegem was a massive loss for Happel. Almost, Happel would have been for Happel, Van Hanegem would have been a bigger boost than Cruyff. The problem was with Cruyff, and for obvious reasons, the way the Dutch played was structured around Cruyff.
Yeah.
And when he pulled out of the tournament before 78, Svartkruis wanted Rensenbrink to play the Cruyff role rather than change the entire system. And Rensenbrink was a wonderful player. One of these massively underrated players because he was very quiet and unassuming. And so, but he did really well with playing with Anderlecht and played wonderfully well for the Dutch, played in both World Cup finals and the 76 European Cup finals, European Championship final as well. And he hadn't got the blustering arrogance, shall I say, that Cruyff had about his ability, and that he didn't want to do it. It's very similar to a situation in 74 when Hahn was a midfield player, was asked to play centre-half, and he didn't want to do it, but Cruyff persuaded him. Mm-hmm. And Cruyff wasn't there to persuade Rensenbrink to be Cruyff, so it sort of didn't really work that way. I think, I mean, the Dutch weren't far away from winning the tournament.
Yeah.
They lost in extra time to the hosts. I think if they had both, I think that would have put it. And Van Hanegem would probably strive to be more important, as I say.
Be more important than Cruyff. That's interesting. I have. I know we're running out of time, but I have one further question, which is kind of maybe more difficult to answer. And I just want to maybe, if the Dutch had won either one of these World Cup finals or the Euros in 76, do you think they would be as fondly remembered? Because I think, the Hungarian team in 54 is remembered far more than West Germany in 54. Or, in 1982, so many people could remember the Brazil team from that, but can barely remember who won it. So do you think that it's sort of an integral part of the story is that they failed to win? Or do you think that it would only add to their legacy if they'd won one of the World Cups?
It's a great question. It's a terrific question. And it's one I've sort of been asked a couple of times. Cruyff had this thing that he said, the tragedy of the loss of 74 is that because it made the Dutch the beautiful losers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very, very famous Dutch author called Ort Kok, who's just written a biography of Cruyff. He was kind enough to give me an interview for the book I'm working on at the moment. He wrote a famous book. I don't know what it is in Dutch, but it's 74, We Were the Best, is the title in English. And he sort of analyzes that how the Dutch carried this burden of not winning 74 for so long. And it was almost like a boil that had built up. And they had to exercise that sort of thing to move on. And the carrying the cross of 74 for a long time almost damaged Dutch football, strangely enough.
Yeah.
But would they have been? I don't know. If they had won in 74, would they have been as highly regarded as the Brazil team that won in 70?
Yeah.
I almost think they would have been.
Yeah, probably right.
They would have gone through the entire tournament without losing a single game if they had won the final. Whereas in 78, obviously they lost to Scotland. I think the regard for the Dutch team, if they'd won in 74, would be different. Perhaps not lesser or greater, but perhaps different.
Yeah. No, I think there would be less of a sort of maybe like a mythology kind of around them. Yeah, like that yeah, kind of aura yeah. that it's
That's the same thing Cruyff said, it made Dutch football. They sort of adopted this persona of being the beautiful losers.
Mm-hmm. And do you think does this sort of beautiful losers thing still continue? Because obviously they won the Euros in 88, but I mean, I do remember, you know, before the World Cup when they played against Spain, and obviously it was a very different Dutch side and sort of attitudes and approaches. But there was still this thing about, you know, this great footballing nation which has never won the World Cup.
Yeah. It's a difficult thing. The team that won in the European Championship in already in Germany under Mikkels back there, this was an entirely different team. They didn't play total football. It was a different formation, different way of playing because the players were different and the players hadn't come through the Ajax and Feyenoord clubs of that era. So they're playing a different sort of football. So the Dutch winning in the European Championship was almost a lesser success.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
For the beautiful football, it was a lesser success. Although, as I say, you know, if you want to win a title, you win it however you can. They were still a great team. Although, strangely enough, in the final, the Soviet Union were probably the better team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you watch the game, I watched the game several times and there. And I think, you know, they had a couple of bad injuries. Protasov was injured, and I can't remember the guy who's injured, Lenikov. So they struggled in the final, but they were still probably the Soviet Union was still a better team. But yeah, I mean, in that championship, they got over the line.
Yeah, just the crucial thing. That's it. All right, thank you so much for your time, Gary. I really enjoyed this. Where does the title of the book? Sorry, did you come up with the title of the book, Beautiful Bridesmaids? Just because I thought it was probably the best named football book I've come across in many a year.
Bless you. Thanks for that. It came out of a podcast we were doing a couple of years ago, and it stuck in my mind. We were talking about I don't know which tournament it was. And we're saying about it might have been the Hungarians, I can't remember. Okay. But we're saying about the team that won it. And I said, I remember this phrase, sometimes you go to a wedding and the bride isn't the most beautiful girl there. Sometimes the bridesmaids are more beautiful. And it stuck in my mind. And when I came to write the book, it came back to me. And I thought, well, yeah, I could stick that in. Because it captures all the things. They were more beautiful than the brides, the teams that won the tournaments. They were the bridesmaids.
But all right, orange. Exactly. Gary, where can people find more of your work, and also what books or stuff to people do you have coming out in the coming year that people look forward to?
Yeah, I have my Twitter page, which all my stuff is always on there, which is @all_blue_days. On Amazon, I have my own Amazon page on there, so if you just go to Amazon, type in Gary Thacker, all my books are on there. And if you ever listen to these Football Times podcast, you can catch me on there as well. I say I've got a book coming out in April, which is about the Chelsea 2012 Champions League triumph. It's called Out of the Blue. Chelsea's unlikely 2012 Championship. And then next year, I'm working on the current book now, which is about the Ajax teams of the 70s. It's called The Dutch Masters, how Ajax's total football conquered Europe. It'll be out in April 2023.
All right, sounds brilliant. And I'd encourage everyone, if they're interested in the subject, to check out the book. It's definitely well worth a read.
Bless you. Thank you very much, Ralph. Thank you.
All right, Gary, thank you so much for joining me. I'll let you get on with your evening.
Thank you. An absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, Alex. Cheers.
All right, take care. Bye now.
Network.